When the MLC Bank failed back at the end of May, it was the first failure in the U.S. in a year and a half. So it really was significant because it did break that record, and even more significant because of the reasons that state regulators cited for closing it, which were insider abuse and fraud by former officers at the bank.
Let's begin with the fire. So when did that happen, and then what chain of events followed?
So the fire was on the evening of Saturday, May 11th. So the evening right before Mother's Day, people probably getting ready for that holiday. And it was really kind of a normal day for someone I talked to, a worker, Teresa Thompson, at the Dairy Queen, which I'm sure Cooper and Delta County residents know is adjacent to the bank. And someone came into the restaurant and, you know, said the bank was on fire. This cook, Teresa, she called 911, and the sheriff's deputies arrived, and that really set off the chain of events where, you know, national investigators were brought in. This bank was closed, and there's still the ongoing investigation into the exact kind of fraud that happened at the bank.
So this fire happened just a few days in advance of a regularly scheduled audit by the state agency that monitors banks. And this is something that any financial institution in Texas would have to do on an annual basis. How often do these investigations happen if it's just a matter of routine?
Right. It is not an exactly annual basis. The frequency at which they're inspected actually depends on the kind of a rating they have. So if it has a better rating, you know, it might be a less frequent inspection, but it's safe to say it's between every 12 and 18 months. And the State Department of Banking does alternate with one of the other banks regulators, the FDIC, on those inspections. So even though the State Department of Banking was doing this year's exam, the FDIC had done the previous one.
So what did first responders find when they responded to the fire? Apparently, the fire didn't get very far. So what did they find when they got into the building?
Right. It didn't get very far. And that was because the door was closed to where the fire happened, which was the conference room of the bank. So not a lot of oxygen for the fire to spread. But on that table in the conference room, there were papers burning. And it was discovered that they were some of the same financial records that the state had requested for their annual or regular inspection.
So not a very, if it was intentionally set, not exactly a pro job there. So,
no.
So obviously that aroused suspicions, and both state and federal investigators then descended on the bank.
Right. So first, the sheriff's office called in the ATF because it was a fire on a property, a business that is federally insured, of course through the FDIC. And the State Department of Banking came in later that week to do their exam. And then after that, I believe the FDIC came in to do their examination. And then there is another agency actually called the FDIC Office of the Inspector General. And those are basically the special agents that come in when foul play basically is believed to have happened. So that would be fraud that happened here or any other kind of financial crime.
And both those investigations remain ongoing.
Yes.
So you mentioned that the FDIC has estimated that it's going to have to reimburse people to a total of about $27 million. Mm-hmm. And you compared that figure with the bank's assets, which is $37 million. So why is that such a striking figure when the FDIC is going to be on the hook for most of the bank's assets, almost three quarters?
Right. So most of a bank's assets in general are things like loans. So for a normal person, a loan would be a liability, but for a bank, it's an asset because, you know, they're making money off that through interest, and they will be paid it back. And so the fact that the FDIC named $27 million means that they're really not sure of the legitimacy of most of those assets. Which is definitely a red flag. Now they will go through a lengthy process to try to, you know, make that number go down as much as possible by selling off the legitimate assets. and by also filing claims against anyone they think, you know, might be culpable to get some money back, and a court could order restitution in the future. But that is their preliminary estimate.
Okay, let's move on and talk about the letters that people write. So these shocking letters. So when did these start? When did these letters start showing up? And they were from not the bank, but they were from the FDIC?
Right, right. So I believe these letters started showing up the week after the bank was closed. Now, the bank was closed on the 31st, but I think that the regulators and the FDIC knew that it would close much longer, much sooner before that. So they were kind of preparing these for a while. So the letters started arriving after the bank was closed. And I believe they went out to everyone who had an obligation, a debt with the bank, which surprised some people who got these letters because they knew they didn't have loans with the bank, or they knew they didn't have this specific loan with the bank. So there were multiple people in Cooper and the surrounding communities who got these letters that they weren't expecting. The letters were kind of just very general form letters from the FDIC saying, you know, you have a loan with this bank, and we're in charge of it now because we're facilitating the transition between the two banks. I kind of gave some updated instructions on what to do with that loan, but the amount that the loan was for was not spelled out in the letter. So in order to figure that out, the recipients would have had to call the bank or go in and meet with the regulators, like Pat Ainsworth, who is mentioned in my story, did. But once they did go in and meet, they found out how much the loans were for, which in a lot of cases was quite a lot of money.
How were these people's fears put to rest? How long did it take for them to get assured that upon review, the FDIC officers had determined that the loans were fraudulent and that they didn't know anything?
Right. So I definitely can't speak for everyone who got one of these letters, but I believe the process was quite streamlined, and the FDIC didn't leave anyone really in a gray area thinking they might be responsible for these loans, because it was pretty easy, it seems, for them to determine which were legitimate and which weren't. So in Pat Ainsworth's case that I mentioned in my story, she went into the bank 2 days after she got the letter, and she met with an investigator, and he basically told her everything in very simple terms and told her she wasn't on the hook for the money, and that was that.
Leaving the topic of the loans and moving on to the people who had checking or savings accounts there. The FDIC insures accounts up to $250,000, and you said in your story that 10 customers had accounts that exceeded that amount, so anything over $250,000 they're going to lose.
Right, right. So the FDIC did say that 10 depositors were over that limit. So that is not great news for anyone who had a significant amount of money in the bank. And that also kind of poses a problem, I believe, for the bank that is taking over, Legend Bank, because when you think about it, those people who lost the money would have been the best customers for this bank that is taking over, would have had the most money. They would have been able to, you know, use that money. So that definitely poses a problem for them.
So you mentioned that banks typically have rules in place to prevent fraudulent loans. The loans are supposed to be approved by a committee, which usually involves the board members of the bank. Is that simply a standard business practice, or is that a regulation that banks are obligated to abide by?
I believe it is both. There are different parts of getting a loan dispersed. So there's a loan officer who usually helps the person apply for a loan, looks at their credit, et cetera. And then there is someone who originates the loan and disperses that loan, who is another person in the bank who actually kind of makes the money flow. But that step isn't supposed to happen until the loan is approved by the loan committee, which is often the job of either the entire board of directors or a portion of the board of directors. So something happened in this bank where that function was not happening, where, you know, the wrong information was being presented to the board, or that the board possibly wasn't doing its due diligence of over. I did speak to a former bank president who's mentioned in the story, Noel Bailey, and he said that back in the day, when he was in charge from about 1975 to 1989, all the directors met on the first Saturday of every month to go over every loan, and unless they were unanimously approved, they did not get they didn't get approval. So things have definitely changed since that time, and something was definitely broken.
So you have a situation here where one person was able to just create these loans out of thin air, or does it appear that more than one person was in on the creation of these fraudulent loans?
You know, that's a good question. I haven't been able to get it down to a specific number of who might have done this or how many people could have been involved. It could have been a group, or it could have been maybe just one person with too much control. So multiple scenarios, and there is definitely still more of a story to be told.
Okay. And then I'm noticing here one of the persons that you interviewed, Terry Rauch, a former FDIC investigator. And Terry provided you with your money quote for this story. So what was that?
With loan fraud, it's never a matter of if you're going to get caught. It's a matter of when you'll get caught.
Were any of the people that you spoke with for this story just incredulous at how sloppily done all of this was, and the idea that somehow whoever did this would get away with it?
Yes. Just a general statement. Everyone in Cooper was extremely friendly, you know, even if they didn't want their name used in the paper. So they would like pass on some rumors they'd heard or really just give me their opinion. And something that was common across a lot of people I talked to was just, number one, the disbelief that, you know, this could happen in somewhere like Cooper. And number two, the desire to, you know, to know more about what was going on with the investigation and to make sure that someone is held accountable. That was a very common thread.
Who all worked on the story besides you?
I did the large amount of the reporting. My editor, Paul O'Donnell, was great about editing my first draft from about 3,000 words into something that is digestible and in the easily readable format that it's in today. And then we also had one of our photojournalists, Linda Gonzalez, come out on one of my trips to Cooper, and she provided most of the photos that are in the story. And then one of our videographers, Brian Elledge, also made it out to town, and he talked to some people around town. And I think he actually falsely started a rumor that there was a TV crew in town, because he came out with his video camera. And then the next week I came back, and somebody said there had been a TV station in town, which I didn't think was true. So that was funny.
Before we wrap it up here, let me just leave it open-ended for you. Is there anything about this story that you think our listeners would be interested in that we haven't discussed yet?
That's a great question, Mark. You know, I always ask this question to anyone I'm interviewing, but it's so much harder to answer when it's being posed to you. I think it's just important to note, you know, what an anomaly a bank failure is in today's day and age. I mean, back in the Great Recession, they were happening left and right, but for one to happen today, it is really rare, specifically because, you know, there are agencies like the FDIC and like the State Department of Banking who are supposed to be doing pretty thorough examinations. So I think a case like this, where it seems like this fraud had been happening for quite a bit of time, that will cause them to kind of reevaluate their own examination methods and hopefully prevent anything like this from happening again.